Same-sex marriage, yes or no, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and for Marco Werman, voters in Ireland went to the polls today to decide if gay marriage should be legal or not. This yes voter says the mood in Dublin is good.
It feels like a big group hug. You know, you really feel that people are very supportive. It's a really great feeling, yes.
But don't write off the no voters just yet. Also on the show, more than 30 groups claim allegiance to ISIS now, but U.S. officials are reluctant to go after all of them.
Washington does not want to get involved in another war in yet another Mideast country, especially at a time when its ally in Baghdad is not really holding the front against the Islamic State in Iraq.
Those stories, plus the jazz link between Japan and New Orleans, ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. It's pretty amazing when you think about it. 25 years ago, homosexuality was still a criminal offense in the Republic of Ireland. Yet by this time tomorrow, same-sex marriage could be legal in the country. Irish voters went to the polls today to decide whether to legalize gay marriage or not. Let's start with the yes vote and two people who would be directly affected by legalization. Justine Quinn is Irish, and her fiancé, Sabrina Schoenfeld, is German. If Ireland votes yes, they plan to be among the first same-sex couples to marry in Dublin. I spoke with them earlier today, and by the way, their voices sound really similar. I started by asking Justine how the day was going.
It's a very nerve-wracking day. I've been following this for a long number of years, and it's been amazing to see public attitudes really change. So it means a huge amount to me.
Sabrina, you are from Germany. You've been living in Dublin for several years. Have you been surprised at how the debate has gone?
Definitely. Ever since I came to Ireland, there was mainly positive reactions to, say, myself being fairly out and holding hands and things like that. At the moment, I say it feels like a big group hug. You know, you really feel that people are very supportive. People actually stop us in the street because they see the yes equality badges and say, we're going to vote yes and best of luck. And it's a really great feeling, yes. And I guess I was positively surprised.
Justine, civil partnerships are already legal in Ireland. You and Sabrina can both already access all the rights of heterosexual couples. Why is marriage so important to you?
Well, actually, it wouldn't be correct to say that we could access all of the rights. There is a significant difference between civil partnership and civil marriage, both in terms of constitutional recognition, but also there are a lot of statutory differences.
But practically, what is the difference between having full marriage rights and civil union rights in Ireland?
Well, practically, I suppose the first thing is that because it's not constitutionally recognized, it could be repealed or it could be weakened by amendment in future. And one of the problems for couples has been that they don't know whether they're entitled to the same treatment or not. And it would really take legal advice to be sure. So if they're questioned in a situation, people are not really able to assert themselves because they're not sure if the position is equal or not.
Sabrina, what about you? Why is marriage so important to you?
Well, I came out when I was 27. And up until then, I guess just like everyone else, I had thought I'm going to get married one day and, you know, have a family and all that. And I guess after having come out, it was around the same time that civil partnership was introduced here in Ireland. And that really made me aware of the fact that actually I cannot get married to the person I want to get married to. And I have yet to hear one really good argument why I should not get married to a woman, because the person I love and want to spend the rest of my life with happens to be female.
Have either of you had any surprised reactions from older relatives?
Not really. The first time I brought Sabrina to a family gathering, something you might be aware of, Irish families are huge, and my family is really large. So we went to a wedding, and it was wonderful. People were so warm and so welcoming, and they really went out of their way to be. It almost felt like it was our wedding. It was unbelievable. And I suppose that really deliberate demonstration of support was lovely. And we'd just gotten engaged shortly before that. And my godmother gave us an engagement present. And it was lovely.
Now, I know if there's a successful yes vote today, you two are hoping to be among the first to marry. Tell us about your plans for your wedding. Sabrina, how about a few details from you?
Yeah, well, we're planning to get married in early September here in Dublin. Justine's family, which, you know, she mentioned, is quite big. And just to kind of keep it even, because my family is really, really small, we're also going to have a part in Germany with my friends and family. So we're looking forward to two really big parties, one here in Dublin and the other one in Berlin.
Sabrina Schoenfeld and her partner Justine Quinn in Dublin. The Yes campaign in Ireland has received support from most of the country's major political parties, but there are vocal No campaigners as well. Kate Bopp is one of them. We reached her by phone in County Galway in the western part of the country. She told me the outcome of this referendum is far from certain.
It'll be a lot closer than earlier reports suggest. The mainstream media would certainly give the impression that the yes side will have a hands-down win. But it's been my experience, and along with fellow volunteers who've been travelling the length and breadth of Ireland and going to meetings and engaging in debate and talking to people, that there's a lot of reservation about this amendment to our constitution. In rural Ireland, there are a lot of questions that aren't being satisfactorily answered by our political class. So it's possible that certainly rural Ireland will have a strong no vote.
Now, you don't support this measure. You're going to vote against same-sex marriage. Why are you opposed to it?
I suppose part of it is the unique way in which marriage is enshrined in our constitution and how it's described in our constitution. What our constitution says is that the state recognizes the family as the natural primary and fundamental unit group of society, and marriage is connected inextricably to family.
But if I were to come back and say, why shouldn't a gay couple, a same-sex couple, be recognized as a family?
As a family. The reason why it's jarring with people is that no matter how much you love your same-sex partner, that same-sex union cannot logically be the natural primary and fundamental unit group, because that definition describes the only reason why the state takes an interest in marriage. Marriage is the only institution recognized within our constitution that binds a man to a woman and to their children that they will produce to the next generation. So that's why it's called a natural and fundamental unit group and a primary fundamental unit group.
Earlier, I spoke to a couple, a female same-sex couple in Dublin. Depending on how the vote goes, they're planning to get married in a Dublin registry office if there's a yes vote. What would you say to them on a day like this?
Well, I would say to them that they really should look again at our civil partnership legislation because it's robust. It's the envy of many US states. In fact, we've had US commentators looking at our civil partnership package, if you like, and saying that it's basically comprehensive. There's only a slight couple of very minor differences that could be tweaked. In fact, this whole thing could have been resolved through legislation. And I think our administration is to blame here because they have set people against one another when this could have been resolved without polarizing the country. You know, there's been a lot of talk of acceptance and understanding, but they shouldn't have tried to redefine marriage and family. They're not making an effort to understand that the historic and universal definition of marriage can't be endlessly malleable. You can't keep changing it. People have been guided to look at this as an equality issue when in fact it's not. It's like throwing a bomb into the Constitution, and it's going to cause an awful lot of problems if it is passed today.
That was Kate Bopp, a No campaigner based in County Galway. For the bigger picture on this Irish referendum on gay marriage, we now turn to Lester Fader. He covers LGBT issues around the globe for BuzzFeed, and he's just back from Ireland.
No other country in the world has held a vote, a national vote, on allowing same-sex couples to marry. There have been a handful of other countries that have held votes on constitutional changes that would prevent same-sex couples from marrying, but this is the first time that the entire population of a country has been asked to vote on this question and could allow same-sex couples to wed.
How did that happen in Ireland as opposed to other countries who have legalized same-sex marriage?
Ireland's constitution has a clause on protecting the family, and that was interpreted by many legal experts as prohibiting same-sex marriage. And the Irish Constitution only allows constitutional change by popular vote. So they did pass a civil union statute a few years ago, and that was permissible under the Constitution. But the fear was that if this was done by an act of parliament, that would be struck down by the courts. So they had to go to the people.
Among marriage equality supporters, is there a preference for how these votes are taken, or is it simply country by country looking at the constitutional issues in each country?
I think a lot of LGBT rights activists would argue that it's inappropriate to put the question of minority rights to a popular vote. And so they would resist that. There's also a political reality, which is until quite recently in most places, if you put this to a popular vote, it would fail. And we've seen that experience in the United States, where the majority of these referenda that we've seen in the U.S. states have passed banning same-sex marriage. And only in the most recent cycle have we begun to see the first victories on the other side.
Like Prop 8 in California.
Well, I mean, Prop 8 was an interesting example because that was the one place that the LGBT rights activists thought they could get the popular vote on their side. And when it failed, it was a really big blow to the movement. And there is some fear among LGBT rights activists that Ireland could prove the same way. The polls have shown consistently overwhelming support for this referendum, but there's a history in Ireland of the gap tightening dramatically in the very last weeks of the campaign. So there's fear that this could go bad, and I think that would be regarded as a setback.
It's interesting because I thought it would be completely the opposite. I thought that going directly to the people would be the most appealing because it would be letting people decide, and so then it's incontrovertible how people actually feel. So I didn't imagine that the preference would be sort of issues.
Well, historically on civil rights questions, courts have led public opinion. I mean, we see that certainly in the United States, both on LGBT rights and on racial equality as well. So there's a long history of believing that the court's job is to protect the rights of the minority from the majority. So the idea of putting that to a popular vote is complicated.
Now, Lester, you've just returned from Ireland. What's your sense of how the vote's going to go down today?
Every indication is that the yes is going to prevail. It's been much more visible. The polls a week out still showed at least a 10-point margin supporting the marriage equality proposal. If people are lying on the surveys, it's hard to know. And certainly the no side would argue that they are being bullied. And that might be keeping some people quiet who wouldn't want to be public in their opposition. But on campaign signs, on posts in the city, seem to be dominated by the yes side. And that's true even in very rural areas where I was. And certainly online, they've been much more visible on Twitter and such. So just remains to see what the actual vote comes in.
Lester Fader reports on LGBT issues for BuzzFeed. Thanks a lot, Lester.
Thank you for having me.
Before we take a short break, a look ahead to a story we've got coming up later in the show. If you can't find anyone to publish your book, well, why not publish it yourself? Who cares if it's a picture book about, say, Lithuanian discos?
You might be the odd kid making the really weird photograph and put it into a publication. Neither your family or your friends or a college, they might understand what the hell you're doing, but there's somebody out there online that will appreciate what you're doing.
That story's coming up right here on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from LegalZoom, for over 10 years providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. One of the darkest days in El Salvador's brutal civil war came in March of 1980. That's when Archbishop Oscar Romero was gunned down as he celebrated Mass in San Salvador. His murder highlighted a sharp divide in the tiny Central American nation. For some on the left, Romero was a martyred hero. Others on the right branded the Catholic cleric a dangerous Marxist revolutionary. That tension is still there in El Salvador now, 35 years later, even as Romero is about to be beatified by the Catholic Church, the first step towards sainthood. A huge ceremony is planned for tomorrow in San Salvador. Luis Lopez Portillo is a Salvadoran writer. You've tweeted about the Archbishop saying, "The move towards sainthood of an assassinated archbishop should be bringing a nation together. It is not." Why isn't it? What's going on?
Because it was made his name was made into a political weapon. You know, we have the former rebels, the FMLN, and they were saying yesterday, this is our saint. This is the left saint. So that kind of things don't help. And the right sees it as a, you know, it should be our saint. And it's very a political topic. So it's a terrible contamination of something religious by politics. And it has been going on for years. And all this time, when you would see FMLN protests, you know, street protests, you would see Romero posters. So it's been an instrument, an ideological instrument. So that's why many on the right are not as happy, you know?
Do you consider yourself on the right?
Yes, yes. Even though I consider someone conservative, I'm trying to make peace with it. I'm trying to leave it behind because it doesn't help me.
So you feel like the current political party, the leftist party that is running El Salvador, sort of appropriated Oscar Romero as a symbol and are using it politically?
Yes, exactly.
Politics aside, if that's even possible in El Salvador, is there any way that Romero's sainthood, if he's eventually made a saint, could that bring El Salvador together?
That's all we hope. That's all we hope. I mean, I have chosen to, you know, leave the past behind because we are a very much polarized country. And if we continue this way, we're not get ahead. So many of us, even though we've grown up seeing Romero through a ideological lens, we want it to be a good thing. You know, we want it to bring us together. But it's very hard because you see today's newspapers are full of interviews about Romero. And you can see some bitterness and you can see the divide and, you know, taking sides. And so it's very hard. And none of the sides wants to let it go. You know, one side doesn't want the other side to take him and vice versa. So it's pretty hard. But, you know, the church is doing the best they can to put it on top, above politics.
I guess you're trying to contrast his image as well, a saint. I mean, in your own writing, you write that Romero is also seen as a guerrilla or guerrillero dressed as a priest, a pastor who took sides with kidnappers, hid outlaws in his chapel, or told the poor that they should take what they could from the rich. That sort of contrasts with his view as a champion of human rights.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I have a friend whose father was kidnapped in 1978. And when the guerrillas finally got the ransom, freedom, Romero was with the ones that handed him back. So this friend of mine says, you know, I can't accept that this man that participated in the guerrillas getting the ransom and liberating him is now being a saint. I can't take that. And I understand her. I mean, it must be very hard. And it's easy for me that, you know, wasn't affected personally. But for some people that live these things, it's very hard to accept him as a saint.
Right. It's also the case, though, if you go back to that time, and there was also sort of right-wing military death squads in El Salvador, and there were a lot of people being simply murdered. And you had presidents and world leaders condemning right-wing death squads and what was going on in El Salvador at the time.
The left was very much more effective in their communication. So the world would see us as if we had the bad guys in one side and the good guys in the other. And that was not really the case. It was bad guys in both sides. And what happens is that we've heard two versions. For 35 years, we've heard two different versions of Romero siding with the poor and human rights. And that is true. I cannot say that it's not true. That is true. But then you hear the other version of Romero siding with guerrillas, siding with kidnappers, hiding outlaws in his chapel, which is apparently also true. So what I'm saying is you have to see both sides of the coin. And many people in this country are not happy with the decision. What I'm saying is that there's many of us, as I'm doing, trying to put this behind. But for some people, it's very hard.
Will you attend the beatification ceremony tomorrow?
Yes. We're trying to leave this behind and accept the church's decision, respect it, and celebrate it. You know,
where will it take place?
It's around our main iconic plaza, which is Salvador del Mundo. Actually, there's a holiday today and tomorrow. So it's going to be a huge, huge, huge thing tomorrow.
Luis Lopez Portillo is a former presidential advisor. He's now a writer in San Salvador, and we will link to his article about Oscar Romero on our website. Thank you so much, Mr. Lopez Portillo.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so I use Twitter for work. I tweet about political cartoons and satire of all sorts, but I wouldn't use Twitter to tell the police my car had been stolen, which is what they do in the Spanish town of Jun. The whole town is using Twitter as the main form of communication between the local government and its residents. People use the social network to report problems with public services and report crime. Officials use it to put out statements and respond to citizen complaints. The mayor of Jun is José Antonio Rodríguez Salas. He explains through an interpreter that the system has helped solve problems big and small.
After receiving a tweet about a broken street lamp, it took our local electrician just over 3 minutes to repair it and post a picture on Twitter. This is the fundamental process of what we call the society of the minute in Jun. Quick questions and an immediate response.
It works pretty smoothly because so many residents are taking part. Jun is home to 3,500 people, and over 90% of them are on Twitter. And according to the mayor, there's an added benefit, more transparency.
Corruption usually occurs when public bodies make decisions about big purchases or contracts. We broadcast everything from local council meetings to meetings between the mayor and companies and decisions about public contracts. We stream all of it live. In this way, we prevent corruption cases.
It's been so successful that Jun could become a model for much bigger cities here in the U.S. The mayor says researchers from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology are studying the town's Twitter experiment.
We have started a project with the MIT and Twitter to bring our model to 4 big cities in the United States: New York, Chicago, San Francisco, and Boston, each one of them with a different characteristic. The question is if you can divide the city into smaller districts. These districts can use Twitter in the same way Jun does.
José Antonio Rodríguez Salas is the mayor of the Spanish town of Jun. He's got his whole town tweeting. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. An American tourist loses his passport in Istanbul. He gets a temporary one and flies back home. Then a reporter calls him and says this.
They've recovered a whole bunch of stolen American ISIS fighter passports, and yours is one of them.
Find out how the story ends coming up right here on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Carol Hills in for Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. President Obama says, quote, "We're not losing the war with ISIS." Senator John McCain calls the president's comment mind-boggling. The truth is hard to gauge. The self-proclaimed Islamic State this week did manage to rout the Iraqi army out of the city of Ramadi and drive the Syrian army out of the strategic city of Palmyra. It now controls half of Syria's territory. But ISIS is not just a military or territorial threat. It's an idea. There are at least 33 extremist groups around the world that have now pledged allegiance to ISIS. But what does it mean to call yourself part of ISIS? Lara Jakes with Foreign Policy Magazine has some thoughts on that in a new article. Lara, you look at the example of Libya, and there's a group there that's called Ansar al-Sharia that's pledged allegiance to ISIS. They're taking and holding territory in Libya. How strong are they?
Well, Ansar al-Sharia is probably the largest jihadi group in Libya. It's the group that was behind the 2012 killing of U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens in Benghazi. Since then, however, their main leader has been killed and their spiritual leader has pledged bayat or allegiance to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who is the leader of ISIS. So it's thrown Ansar al-Sharia into a bit of a mix. There are some intelligence agencies that believe Ansar al-Sharia is part of ISIS. There are some who do not. But what is undeniable is that this branch, in the name of ISIS, has been conducting suicide bombings, raids on military installations across Libya. They are seen as quite a large threat, especially on the coastal towns.
Do we know if there's any ISIS personnel or funds going to Libya to support Ansar al-Sharia?
Yes. U.S. and European, and in fact, Mideast intelligence officials all say that there have been at least some ISIS leaders going directly from Iraq or Raqqa, which is the ISIS base in Syria, down to Libya to help Ansar al-Sharia get more acclimated to how to fight, how to overcome its adversaries in Libya in the manner that the Islamic State does. So there is definitely a connection between, according to intelligence officials, the Islamic State in its base and the Ansar al-Sharia militants in Libya.
Where does the Obama administration stand on that? What's going on internally around wrestling this issue to the ground? Because it has direct implications for what they should be doing to combat ISIS.
So the Obama administration is very torn on what to do about this global spread of the Islamic State and whether some of these outcroppings are in fact the Islamic State. And one reason why they are so hesitant to start declaring some of these distant provinces is because that could potentially compel them to move in militarily against some of these outcroppings. For example, if the coalition decides that Ansar al-Sharia in Libya is in fact a recognized affiliate of the Islamic State, it could force the coalition, which is led by the United States, to then go in and use military force against these militants in Libya. Washington does not want to get involved in another war in yet another Mideast country, especially at a time when it's not really holding the front. Its ally in Baghdad is not really holding the front against the Islamic State in Iraq. And there is a school of thought, and it's probably a very smart one, that in order to defeat the Islamic State, you really have to strike at its heart. You really have to defeat the caliphate in Iraq and in Syria before you can take on some of these affiliates. Having said that, the affiliates are starting to pose a greater threat to some of our allies, including Italy, including Egypt. And those partners who have contributed a lot to this anti-ISIS coalition are now saying, hey, we need to get something back for this investment that we have put into this coalition. Ergo, we need to start confronting this threat that is more of a problem for us than what's happening in Iraq and in Syria.
Laura Jakes is the Deputy Managing Editor of News for Foreign Policy. Laura, thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Next door to both Syria and Iraq, Turkey serves as a transit point for many would-be ISIS recruits and for refugees fleeing the war in Syria. Western tourists travel there in large numbers, too. And if one of those tourists were to lose his passport while on Turkish soil, well, that could get interesting. That's exactly what happened to Sam Nair. I'll let him tell the rest of the story.
Well, this was right around the end of December, and my lovely girlfriend and I were traveling around Istanbul. And it was the second day of our trip when we were hitting sort of all of the major touristy sites in the old part of Istanbul. And we went to Hagia Sophia, which is a landmark of the old city, and we went to the Spice Market, and we went to the Blue Mosque. And I was carrying my passport in this sort of sash that I had under my coat. It was wintertime, so I was still wearing a heavy winter coat. And my passport was in a little pocket that was zipped underneath a buckle. And at some point, we stopped for coffee or tea or something, and I went to take something else out of my bag and noticed that that pocket with the zipper was open, and my passport was gone. And so as far as I knew, that was it. My passport had been pickpocketed.
So what did you do when you realized you'd lost your passport?
Well, I finished my coffee because I figured can't do much about it now. And then that night, I went on the internet at the hostel and I declared it stolen, I think, on the State Department's website. And the next morning, I took 3 buses and a train to get to the U.S. consulate and got a temporary passport from there.
So did they say anything when you reported your passport stolen?
Well, you know, it was interesting because everyone had sort of different information. The hostel owner, who is incredibly nice and helpful, took me to the police to make a report because he assumed I would need a report at the consulate in order to prove that it was stolen. And he took me there and he translated for me, and the police could not care less that my passport was stolen. They were like, no, we're not going to write a report. So, I mean, that was about it. I went to the embassy or the consulate, sorry, without any kind of documentation but my Michigan driver's license, and that was enough for them to sort of believe me and issue me a temporary passport.
So you go about your business, finish your trip, you get back to the U.S., you're back into your routine. Then what happened?
Yeah, well, around end of April, I get an email and a Facebook message from this reporter, Mike, who says he's from BuzzFeed, and who's telling me that he's doing a story in Istanbul, and he's a correspondent there, and my name came up, and do I have a couple minutes to chat? And, you know, I'm kind of surprised, and I sort of answer him something a bit tongue-in-cheek along the lines of, well, hey, Mike, nice to meet you, but I've had dealings with friendly Nigerian princes before, so why did my name come up?
What did he say? How had your name come up?
Yeah, well, what he told me is that, I'm paraphrasing, but it was something along the lines of, there are murky characters here in Istanbul that have dealings with Syria, and they've recovered a whole bunch of stolen American ISIS fighter passports, and yours is one of them. And so that kind of terrified me. You know, he did mention that none of these passports and none of the people in the passports had anything to do with ISIS. They were just being sort of sold under false pretenses.
So this BuzzFeed reporter had been doing a piece about stolen passports, and in his reporting had come across your passport as one that had been circulating in illegal circles?
Correct. And at the time, I didn't know if he had actually seen my passport or seen a picture of it. What I came to understand with time is that apparently there's a whole network of sort of smugglers and more or less organized criminals that have a bunch of these pickpocketed passports. And the pictures in the passports almost become like trading cards on smartphones that the networks send each other and are eventually used to see if there's a match for refugees in Syria that look like the people in the passports. And in order to help refugees, I believe, make it into Europe with American passports.
Was the BuzzFeed reporter able to determine whether anyone had used your passport in that way?
As far as I know, there had not yet been a match on my passport. I know that it had changed hands a couple times and made its way into the hands of, I guess, one of the more big-time smugglers in Istanbul. But the passport never actually left Istanbul and, to my knowledge, has not been used yet. But, you know, by now that could have changed.
Did you report what happened to the FBI or any other organization?
Well, when he first contacted me with that initial, you know, we have these American ISIS fighter passports and yours is one of them, my first phone call was to my dad because parents always seem to know what to do. And after that, I called the State Department. It was kind of unhelpful. They kind of said, well, did you declare it stolen back in December? And I was like, yeah. And they're like, oh, so I guess we have that form. And then I left a tip on the FBI's website.
Do you worry at all that if you travel overseas again with your new passport that you're going to end up on some list and run into difficulty?
No, it hasn't really crossed. I mean, I guess it crossed my mind, but it's not a way you want to live your life. You know, I kind of tend to assume that the best will happen, and that's probably why things like getting my passport stolen happened to me in the first place. But no, it's not something I worry about.
Sam Nair is a medical student. Well, he's actually just graduated. Congratulations, Sam. He's now a doctor. And he had his passport stolen when he was traveling in Turkey in December. Thanks so much, Sam.
Hey, thanks, Carol.
Signs of trouble for the publishing industry have been around for a while. Small bookstores shutting down, big bookstore chains consolidating. But there's one small corner of publishing that's definitely thriving: self-published photography books. Here's Alina Simone with the story.
John Phelan started collecting photo books about 4 years ago.
Photo books are, in terms of art books, the closest you can get to the actual product.
Oh, how many photo books do you have?
I'm not really sure, but it's somewhere north of about 3,500.
The majority of those books are self-published. The fact that they're often issued in very limited editions, sometimes hand-numbered or signed, makes them fetishized works of art in and of themselves. Self-publishing may still have a bad rap in the literary world as an option of last resort for those who couldn't get their book past the traditional gatekeepers.
And yet here, in photo books, particularly in self-published photo books, we have this incredible oasis where it's flourishing. You know, books sell out in days sometimes, not even in weeks.
That's right. Self-publishing is hot. So hot that John has helped create the first international self-published photography book prize, the Anamorphosis Prize. Entries have already begun streaming in from all over the world. I'm no good at staring at unopened packages, so...
It's interesting. It looks like a book about spaghetti westerns.
From Italy.
From Italy, yeah.
One of these photographers will win $10,000. 20 will have their self-published books added to the permanent collection of MoMA in New York, which is kind of magical if you think about it, because unless you're an established photographer, getting published is really hard.
It's difficult for younger photographers to get published. When they do get published, often they have to put their own money up.
Andrew McSheesh experienced the runaround firsthand. He's a Lithuanian-American photographer who's been based in Vilnius for the past 15 years.
A publisher will say, like, oh, Andrew, this looks really good. You know, maybe we can just keep talking about it, and then you send them more, but there's still no answer. So at a certain point, I just said, okay, fine. I'm not going to wait anymore. I'm just going to make my own book. And the first book that I did was in 2007. I did a book of the Roma, the gypsies in Lithuania.
Since then, Andrew has published the award-winning Disco, a book he funded using Kickstarter, which documents the still-thriving social scene around Lithuania's disintegrating Soviet-era dance halls. It immediately sold out. Andrew discovered not only could he do everything he needed to publish a world-class photo book from Lithuania, he could do it better.
People think Lithuania is, you know, far off in the way, way Eastern Europe, but it's not. You know, it's part of the European Union. We're on the Euro now. And it's a really great place to print books and for a huge, huge discounted price compared with everywhere else.
So much so that Andrew has recently become a self-publishing consultant. And if a traditional publisher came to him today asking to publish his work?
I would really have to think about it, because doing it yourself, it's like, I think it's, yeah, there is more, almost like a more of a prestige to doing that now than doing it with a big publisher sometimes.
It turns out publishers themselves feel that itch too, like Bruno Cheskel, who was working for a London-based publisher when he realized the artists he most wanted to work with weren't a good fit for the mainstream press. 5 years ago, he created Self-Publish Be Happy, an online distribution platform for self-published photo books.
It goes from literally somebody printing black and white at home with a really simple printer, just folding and stapling, to really elaborate and expensively produced books.
Some have already gone on to become collector's items worth thousands. But the best thing about these books isn't the promise of profit, but the hidden worlds they reveal, scenes we'd never have access to if it wasn't getting cheaper and easier to publish books about things like Lithuanian discos.
You might be the odd kid making the really weird photograph and putting it into a publication. Neither your family or your friends or a college, they might understand what the hell you're doing, but there's somebody out there, you know, online that will appreciate what you're doing.
Maybe that's the greatest thing about self-publishing. It lets photographers fly their freak flag high. What's not to love about that? For The World, this is Alina Simone.
You can see some of the photos Andrew McSheesh decided to self-publish. They're at PRI.org. And you're tuned to The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from LegalZoom, for over 10 years providing solutions for business owners to get legal help, including corporate filings and legal plans featuring attorney contract review and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Next week is one of my favorite weeks of the year. It's the National Spelling Bee. Kids from around the country will descend on Maryland for the title of U.S. Spelling Bee Champion. Meanwhile, around the globe, there's another competition heating up in Beijing this weekend. Who's going to be the next English-speaking champion? The contest in China, called the CCTV Star of Outlook English Competition, is one of the largest English-language speaking competitions in the world, and the world's Nina Porzucki is there. Nina, you're in Beijing for the regional finals, which start tomorrow. What's the mood like?
Actually, I'm about an hour and a half outside of Beijing in this compound where hundreds of kids are running around, practicing their English speeches, mostly hitting each other and playing. And it's pretty exciting. They were gathered today and they got their number for when they're going to do the competition tomorrow, when they're going to speak tomorrow and have their speech competition. And they got to parade across a red carpet to the tune of the Olympic anthem. So a lot of anxious kids, but more anxious than that are the parents. Oh my God, Carol, so many helicopter parents to be sure.
I can imagine. So give me a little background. What exactly is the CCTV Star of Outlook English Competition, which has a rather odd name?
Well, kind of imagine Spelling Bee meets American Idol. CCTV is actually the largest television network here in China. It's the state TV network. And about back in the year 2000, they started this English competition. And it started small, but today about 5 million kids in 30 provinces compete to be the champion of English in the country of China, which is, you can imagine, is quite something.
So how exactly does it work?
So the kids get scored on several things. Tonight, they started with a written test, and then there's a speech competition, and there is kind of a question and answer round, and then there's the talent competition. To give you kind of a little taste, one of the judges this weekend, his name is David Moser. He's been living in China for a long time, and he's been judging this competition for a very long time. And I just wanted to play you just a little bit of David questioning one high school contestant in the years past.
I want to have you do some more asking where the toilet is with different styles of English. So ask where is the bathroom in British English.
Okay. Excuse me, I need to take a leak.
Okay, rap English.
Rap English. Yo, yo, dude, David, I need to go to the bathroom, so show me the way, dude.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Harry Potter English.
Excuse me, Professor Dumbledore, can you tell me the password to the lavatory?
Wow. That's a rather interesting line of questioning.
I know. I mean, who knew that there was Harry Potter English?
What do these kids get out of it? I mean, what's the prize?
When you get to the national competition, they actually do have university officials who come from the States, from the UK, and take a look at the kids. But the actual prize is kind of like the notoriety and fame itself. So if you get onto the CCTV finals, you're in front of not 5 million, you know, other competitors. You're in front of, you know, hundreds of millions of Chinese folks watching you be the best at English as you possibly can be. So it's a little bit about the notoriety. And hopefully I will check in on Monday and let you know who is the big Beijing finalist. It's a very exciting weekend here.
The world's Nina Perzuki in Beijing for the regional finals of CCTV's Star of Outlook English competition. Thanks, Nina.
Thanks so much, Carol.
There's going to be a festive parade/funeral tomorrow in New Orleans, a second-line funeral, they call it down there. It's just the New Orleans way to pay your respects. This particular funeral is an important one and bound to be really big. It also highlights something that casual music fans and tourists may not notice when they go to the Crescent City, a connection with Japan. The World's Marco Werman is in New Orleans. It's his first stop on his writing residency with Amtrak. Marco, what's going on? Who's being buried tomorrow?
Carol, a guy named Travis Hill, better known as Trumpet Black, that was his stage name. He was 28 years old, and Trumpet Black was headed to Japan at the end of April. He's a huge, huge star there. He's toured there several times, and he left New Orleans with a toothache, which got infected on the plane. It worsened on the plane, and then spread through his body by the time he landed in Tokyo, and then he was hospitalized. And then he was dead by May 4th. It's just really tragic. There's even a picture on his Facebook page on the 30th of April giving a shout-out to his Japanese fans who had T-shirts printed, Trumpet Black and the Heart Attacks, the name of his band.
Oh, that is such a sad story. The guy was so young and so talented. But what's the connection between Japan and New Orleans?
Yeah, that's really intriguing. It's a love affair that goes back to the Japanese love of Louis Armstrong and Dixieland jazz, and that goes back to post-war Japan. You could even say it goes back even before the war. One of the first Japanese who really got this New Orleans bug big time was a trumpet player in the late 50s named Yoshio Toyama. He totally loved Satchmo. He mimicked him. He copied his riffs, became known as the Satchmo of Japan. Today, though, you've got that same bug coming from young Japanese players. They're all over New Orleans, and they're in bands that have big fans in Japan, so the audience love goes in both directions. So even in Trumpet Black's own band, there's a killer guitarist named Jun Yamagichi. He's amazing to watch. He goes into like these Carlos Santana riff trances. Kermit Ruffin's a great jazz trumpeter. In his band, the Barbecue Swingers, he's got a guy named Yoshitaka Z2 Tsuji. And there's a woman trombone player named Haruka Kikuchi. So it may not be obvious to a lot of people watching the music here, but the Japanese players are here. They're respected. And it's like they're just part of the local scene now.
That's amazing. Now, is the relationship between Japan and New Orleans, does any of it have anything to do with the parallel disasters of Hurricane Katrina and then the awful 2011 tsunami in Japan?
Yeah, those two things did a lot. So with Katrina, there was the Tipitina Foundation, which is a local foundation to support New Orleans music, especially young musicians. Tipitina Foundation had started before Katrina, but it got a lot of support post-Katrina from Japanese music schools and programs, bringing instruments over to New Orleans to replace damaged ones. And then with the 2011 tsunami in Japan, the love got paid back when the New Orleans musicians were holding fundraisers for musicians in the hardest hit areas of Northeast Japan. There was this New Orleans sax legend, Donald Harrison. He went to the tsunami zone in Tohoku with some other players from New Orleans. And, you know, from what I've read, they got a real kick in the slats when they saw what the tsunami did to Japan. It was just like being re-traumatized and seeing Katrina all over again.
The World's Marco Werman in New Orleans. And by the way, Marco has been taking some great pictures. Check him out on Instagram. He's at Marco Werman. Marco, thanks, and enjoy the rest of your trip.
Thanks a lot, Carol.
And we'll close with the late Travis Trumpet Black Hill on the horn. The World's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, brought to you by PRI's Global Reporting Fund, supporting its diverse reporting efforts, including ongoing global health coverage and its Across Women's Lives initiative. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman, the Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, Garrett and Cecilia Boone, and the Gruber Family Foundation. By the Skoll Foundation, supporting innovative solutions to the world's most pressing problems with the Skoll Award for Social Entrepreneurship. More information is available at skoll.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by the Ford Foundation, by the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, and by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney-Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Nora Hall, and by the National Endowment for the Arts.
PRI, Public Radio International.